And welcome again to Theories of Reality. I'm Professor Borrowdale. So today we're going to be talking about free will again, and this time talking about the libertarian arguments. So last time we talked about determinism, all the arguments why you don't have free will. And recall that libertarians and determinists both agree on what free will is. Free will is having the ability to do otherwise under identical circumstances. And remember, it's important that the under identical circumstances part says if you have exactly the same circumstances, if you're a determinist, people would do exactly the same thing. Now, a determinist can recognize if there are different circumstances, different causes, different effects. So the determinist isn't locked into the position that says, oh, well, people would act like robots, or people would all be the same, right? Because people have all sorts of disparate causes with their genetics, their heredity, that go into the person they become, their culture, their environment, and so all those things work together to create different kinds of people according to the determinists. It's just that given exactly those same circumstances, that same genetic code, that those same events that happened in that person's life, exactly the same experiences, there's no way they could have done otherwise or done anything other than what they did do. So the libertarian position says that we do have the power to do otherwise. So determinists say that under identical circumstances, you do not have the power to do otherwise. There's only one thing you could have done. So even though it may seem like there's several different alternatives and you can choose from any of them, really, given all of the things leading up to your choice is only going to turn out one way. And we looked at several different arguments for that, and just, you know, by way of review. And again, these are all summarized in your text. The argument from determinism in physics that says that it's all about the laws of cause and effect, and the fact that we live in a material world, which leads to to your actions being determined. That the world sort of works like a clock. Human beings and human decisions aren't outside the material world. We're material beings. We have material brains, which work according to electrochemical laws. And that basically psychology boils down to biology. Biology boils down to chemistry. Chemistry boils down to physics. And it's all basically matter in motion. And so, since matter obeys these deterministic laws, therefore we are determined. You have the behaviorist argument from B.F. Skinner, which says that people are just conditioned to give the responses they have based on their environment primarily, and also with perhaps a hereditary component. Skinner really focused on the way in which our environment determines the responses we give. There's a psychoanalytic argument from Sigmund Freud that says that we're driven by unconscious motives that we have no awareness of. Our personality is formed very early in life, and so as we grow through life, we have all these things that happen with our parents and early childhood traumas, which, you know, come back to bite us later on, and also a good thing. So if you had positive role models, if you had a loving father and a nurturing mother who didn't coddle you, disciplined you in the right way, and so on, you're going to be a well-adjusted adult. But if you had problems, you're going to have all these unconscious conflicts, you're going to have dysfunctional behavior, and all those you can see evidence for unconscious motives in people, typically with problems. That's where it's easiest to see. And so you have a person who continues to engage in a series of self-defeating behaviors. For example, like Whitney Houston, you know, here's a woman who's got amazing talent, makes millions and millions of dollars, could have anything she wants, and what does she want? She wants her next fix. She's hooked on the drugs, and she dies in her bathtub at 48, probably, probably, I would guess, drug-related. A long history of drug abuse problems. Why is that? And the Freudian would say, well, that doesn't make any rational sense. But if you look at what's going on with her, subconsciously, she's probably got all sorts of problems related to dealing with fame. And probably these things go back maybe to early childhood. Unresolved conflicts, and that's why she's married to Bobby Brown, who would knock around and beat her up, and she stayed with him for years. And so you think, if you're with in a relationship where the person is beating the hell out of you on a regular basis, or at least beating the hell out of you occasionally, and beating you up now and again, not severely enough that you're going to go out with a black eye, but is violent, you think, well, you'd be out of there. So, why do women stay? And again, the Freudians would say it's all these weird things bubbling up for the unconscious. Usually it's daddy issues, right? My father never loved me. My father was a drunk alcoholic. I know I'll find someone just like my father, a drunk alcoholic, and if I can get him to love me, that will be like my father loving me. Doesn't make any conscious, rational sense at all, but your unconscious is not rational. And so that's the Freudian argument. And then the theological determinist argument, or the Calvinist argument, says that if there is a God, that God determines what we do. And there's also a sort of a variant of this. So there's the theological determinist argument that says that God actually determines what happens, and that he's predestined all human behavior. But then there's another argument that's similar that says that if there's a God, it just his knowing everything precludes free will. Because if God knows everything, then God knows what you'll do tomorrow. And so therefore, what you'll do tomorrow is set in stone. You can't do other than what God infallibly knows. And so the argument is, if you believe in God, you also can't believe in free will. So even if God is not sort of micromanaging the world and determining your reaction, simply the fact that he knows what you will do shows that the world is deterministic. And so those are the four major arguments for determinism. Now, the libertarian will make some counterarguments to these. And the first one we're going to talk about, I don't know if I want to scroll on the board here. I'll just write these up. I'll write these things. Get my pen. So libertarianism, and so the argument from indeterminism in physics says that if you think about the world and look at the way it acts and look at innovations in physics, starting with Einstein, it says that the world and its basic structures isn't like a clock. It's not like they thought in the Renaissance that the world is sort of like a clockwork mechanism, which was their model of the world. That the world is more like a cloud. If you look at the way matter behaves at the subatomic level, you see that it doesn't act with exactness. It's a matter of probability. So you have Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty, which says that if you're trying to look at, suppose you have a nucleus of an atom and you got an electron going around it. Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty. Heisenberg says you can't tell both how fast the electron's going and where it is. You can't determine velocity and position at the same time. If you know one, you can't know the other. And there's also this is a kind of subtlety, but the Köppen Hagen's interpretation of this is not that there's something with our measurement that we're having a problem, that we can't figure it out. It's, you know, that we can't figure, that there's a problem that we can't figure out how fast it's going and where it is at the same time. It's just because our instruments aren't good enough. The Copenhagen interpretation says that it's a matter of probability that it is in principle unpredictable where that electron is going to be, because matter doesn't behave according to deterministic principles, that it's a matter of probability. It acts sort of erratic and in this unpredictable way. And you can see this with radioactive elements. So you have some radioactive element and it's emitting particles. Well, you can know, like, on average, over a long period of time, that it's going to emit maybe 60 particles per second, right? You have some, and so you got your little Geiger counter there, and you're counting the clicks, and you go over a long haul, and it's 60 particles per second. But then, if you look maybe on a graph, you could see, well, some minutes would be 59, some would be 61, sometimes it might be 65, other times it might be 60. It might be 52, and so there might be a range over time. But if you chart the long haul, it's about 60. But you can't know that it's like every. It's not like every second it goes click, 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 like a clock hand. You know, like the second hand on a clock, going from click to click. And if you ever heard of Geiger counter, right? You put up to a radioactive element, it's sort of like click, 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 click. And you don't know when that next click's going to come. You can just sort of make a generalization about how many clicks you're getting, but you can't determine with certainty when that next particle is going to be emitted. And that, again, is because radioactive elements, and where you're dealing with, you know, these microphysical particles, that they don't obey these exact laws where you can know with certainty what's going to happen next. It's a matter of guesswork. It's a matter of probability. And so the argument is that if you look back at the determinist argument for determinism in physics, it's making an erroneous assumption that matter is determined. And so you get a philosopher named Karl Popper who uses this to argue for free will. And Karl Popper says, look, matter is not determined. We are material beings. Oops. We are material beings. Therefore, we are not determined. So this is the opposite of the argument of the materialist that says we're material beings, matter is determined, therefore we're determined. This just argues the opposite way. And if the argument is that in its basic structure, matter is not determined, it behaves according to these indeterministic laws, then you end up with human behavior, which is in principle unpredictable. And if your brain is working a certain way and you can't predict what brain state your brain's going to be in next, assuming that determinism is true, then if you assume materialism, that you're not determined. And so that is not just a counter-argument, but it's a positive argument in favor of indeterminism, or and then they'll say, if you're not determined, therefore you're free. And you see a version of this in Democritus, fairly early version. So Democritus says, Democritus has this idea of the swerve of atoms. So he'll say, if you observe, stay in frame here. Democritus will say, if you observe atoms moving around in your brain that most of the time they kind of obey these regular laws, but occasionally one swerves off in one direction and for no apparent reason. And he recognized this sort of indeterminism in physics, and he says that that's you know, atoms just sometimes they go off in some strange direction for no reason, and that might cause you to do something out of character or something unusual. And that, he said, was what gave the power of free will. So this is a kind of more sophisticated version of Democritus's argument. Let's see. So the question is this a good argument? So there's a couple of problems with this, and a couple of attacks you might see where you could go against this. So one argument you could make is, okay, well, are we really material beings? And you could say maybe our bodies are free, but our souls are determined. And this is kind of goes back to the cycle, the theological determinist. So you might say, man has, and this is again the opposite of a deterministic argument. A theological determinist argument says we're not material beings; our souls are determined, but our bodies are free. And so here you might make that criticism. You might say, okay, well, maybe we're not material beings. Maybe we have souls, and they're the determined part of us. And even though our bodies sort of behave chaotically and unpredictably, the decisions we make, which happen in our minds, which are immaterial substances, are not determined. Are determined. So that's one way you go. And not super intuitive. The other thing you could do, though, is say, well, wait a minute. Just because things are sort of chaotic at a microphysical level, does that mean they're that way in the macro level? So all the, you know, Heisenberg's principle of uncertainty has to do with electrons. You're dealing with what's happening at the atomic level or the quantum level, and you get all these weird things happening. And so you look, oh, here's another weird physics experiment that says we can't predict what's going to happen next. But once you get to the size of medium-sized material objects, which, you know, include your brain, which is a, you know, a lump of matter about 2 or 3 pounds, you end up getting regular effects. So you don't have to make room for Einstein's equations, which, you know, or and relativity and all the weird stuff that you find in physics, unless you're dealing with either the very massive or the very small. So subatomic level, you get weird stuff happening. If you're going to send a rocket, or, you know, say a probe to Saturn, you better damn well know the adjustments for relativity, because Newton's laws is going to cause you to miss. So if you're dealing with things on a massive scale, like the planetary size objects, or if you're dealing with a very tiny microphysical particles, then you have to make adjustments for relativity. But when you deal with medium-sized material objects, Newton's laws pretty much work. And you don't have to make any adjustments. And at the level of human decision, it seems like what's going on in your brain, it's just, you know, it's electricity going around your nerve fibers. You're not, it's streams, it's not just one electron, it's millions and millions of electrons, streams of electrons moving around your brain. And so that, you might think, just behaves according to the deterministic laws that we observe around us. And so the argument would be that we're back to determinism again, because you can't take the chaos that you detect in the micro level and apply it to the macro level. You can't go from talking about particles, individual particles or small groups of particles at the microscopic scale, to talking about what huge amalgamations of these particles are going to do, which make up medium-sized material objects. It seems that once you get to the macro level of medium-sized objects, that things behave deterministically. A third objection you could make is, you could say, well, just because you're not determined, does that mean that you're free? And it seems like what you could say is it just seems sort of random. So you have people with Tourette's syndrome, right? So and this causes people to have sort of weird twitches and spasms, and they kind of switch their head a weird way. And sometimes they'll shout out swear words. Now imagine if you have Tourette's syndrome, right? You're sitting into a restaurant having a nice meal. All of a sudden, you like shout a four-letter word. People are staring at you, right? Eventually, maybe the manager asks you to leave. That's not something you want to do. That's not something that's happening voluntarily. The same thing with like a nervous twitch. If I'm trying to give a lecture here, and all of a sudden I'm going right and kind of like. My limbs are twitching. I don't want to do that. That's not a conscious free will choice I'm making. It's something that's happened to me. And it might be this just sort of happens randomly. I've got some neurological disease that causes me to kind of spaz out, right? And cause my body to twitch. That's not really free will, even though it's indeterministic. If at random times my body sort of does these weird twitchy things or I shout swear words, that's not free will. And imagine what it would be like if your decisions were like that, right? So again, we're saying not determined. Suppose your decisions are like, you know, what's going to have come next? What new particle? When's that particle going to come? Or can't tell where that electron is. We know how fast it's going. Can't know how fast it's going if we know where it is. It would be like rolling the dice every time you would make a decision. Should I go to the prayer meeting or should I shoot up Coke and rob the 7-Eleven store? Should I beat my wife for Valentine's Day or bring her flowers? And then, every day you walk out of your house. Should I go to work like I normally do? Or should I go down to the racetrack, which I've never been to before, and, bet on the dogs or whatever. So you look at all the things you might do, and people are creatures of habit. They have patterns based on their choices, based on their character, based on the things they like and don't like. And it seems that a free will decision has to be based on your wants and desires, which are formed over a lifetime. And so, they change over time. But your character and your personality, those are things which have some relative fixity to them. And just having random events where you do something for no apparent reason, you go out and rob a bank, or you... what else? What are the random thing you might do? Get up on the table and start tap dancing, right? All the weird things you might do, well, you're not going to do those things. And if you do, what do we usually think? Oh, there's something wrong with his brain, right? Barrowdale's having a breakdown. He's jumped up on the table and he's doing a tap dance badly. He needs help. And so they do a talk screen, right, to see if you're not on the drugs. Oh, and then they put you in the psych ward because something's gone wrong with your brain. Why? Because when a person is making rational free will choices, they don't behave erratically and they don't make random choices. Their choices have reasons behind them. They have, and these reasons form themselves into an intricate interlocking pattern that represent the person's values and their beliefs and their worldview. Right. So all those things sort of fit together. Random things happening to your brain, that's not a model for free will. So even though initially it seems like it might have something going for it, the argument for indeterminism in physics is not a good argument. Now, I suppose if you see it just as a refutation of the argument for determinism in physics, is it going to work then? I think still the micro-macro level thing is going to be a problem for you, right? So you're still left trying to say that what goes on in the brain is not deterministic because of these weird physics things that happen on the micro level. The question is, are those going to happen on the macro level? And you might have some debate over, there might be some room for debate about, how deep the structures of the brain go and so on. But it seems like at least that's a question you would have to answer. A more plausible argument, I think, is this argument for moral responsibility. Put that up here. If I want to use more of the board here. Can I use this other section of board and see if people are going to read this?
Oh, awesome.
So, the argument for moral responsibility.
Make sure my recorder here is
pick me up for the audio podcast. So the argument for moral responsibility and what's going on with the argument for moral responsibility is you think, okay, I make a decision and I might feel guilty if it turns out badly, or I might feel really good if it turns out good. And I think I deserve credit for that. I'm the one that made the decision. And in a world of determinism, nobody's responsible for their actions. And so you think about, suppose a person gets in a drunk driving accident, right? So somebody goes to the bar and they guzzle a bunch of alcohol and they plow into a crowd of school children waiting for the bus early in the morning, right? They're up drinking really late, and then they decide they're going to drive to the liquor store that opens at 7, and some kids out in the rural area getting taken a long bus ride and into the big city to go to school, and just plows right into them, right? It kills a dozen of them. And so, and maybe cripples some more. And so most people would say that person is a bad person. They deserve to be punished to the fullest extent of the law because they knew that drinking and driving was bad. They knew that it was dangerous. They knew there was a high probability of something bad happening and even someone being killed. And so therefore that person deserves to be punished. And that's a normal human response. So if you're a determinist, can you really say that, though? You know, the determinist will say the person, even though they made a conscious choice, where did that choice come from? That choice was a result of causes. Maybe the person has an unconscious conflict that they need therapy for. Maybe the person was conditioned by the way their parents behaved and the role model they grew up with to become an alcoholic. They have the disease of alcoholism and physical addiction, which compels them to drink. And so they have all these things going on with them, which is causing them to do that. And the determinist will say there wasn't anything they could have done that morning other than plow into the school children, that it was determined. So if you couldn't have done otherwise, how can you be responsible for your behavior? You're just a victim of your environment, of your genetics. Or if you want to go to the sort of metaphysical, cosmological, to fate, or God's will, or what have you, if everything is determined to happen a certain way, then, you know, que sera, sera, what will be, and you don't have anything to say about it. So then how can you be morally responsible for your actions? And so the argument for moral responsibility says, no, people really are responsible for their actions. The fact that we feel like that person deserves to be punished shows something about the nature of action, and it shows that we presuppose that person has free will. Because we would never want to blame or praise people if we thought they weren't responsible for their actions. Do you praise someone for being handsome? Do you praise someone for being tall? Right? No, that's something they can't. You might want to be tall like them, so you might admire them. But you don't say, you know, you look at a basketball player, you might praise his prowess, his physical prowess and his ability, but you don't say, oh, great job being so tall, right? Because you don't have any control over how tall you are. So in the same way, the determinist will say you don't have control over anything. So you don't know whether when you don't have no control over your actions, that your actions are determined by previous causes. And so if that's true, you have no responsibility for your actions. So moral responsibility and free will go hand in hand. And so the determinist is going to say, well, most determinists, unless you're a compatibilist, which we'll actually be talking about next week. But if you're a determinist, you're going to say, well, yeah, I know, it seems like that people are responsible for their actions, but really that's just an illusion. And, you know, B.F. Skinner wrote this book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, that we talked about last time. And he says we really need to get beyond this, you know, blame and praise and punishment, you know, punishing someone because they deserve it. Now, there's one reason you might punish a person, and that's to try to get them to behave differently. And what we need to do is figure out what causes people to do what, figure out the causes and effects, and then try to engineer the great society, figure out what makes people do the things they do, and what causes dysfunctional behavior. So there are no good people or bad people. There's no right and wrong. There's just functional and there's dysfunctional. And so what we want to do is try to elicit functional behavior and try to rehabilitate dysfunctional behavior. And so instead of treating a person as a criminal who's a bad person, who's responsible for their actions and deserves punishment if they've done wrong and deserves praise if they've done right, what we want to do is figure out what that person, what made that person, you know, do something wrong, and then figure out a way to get them to respond more positively. So the argument from moral responsibility says that's crazy. No, you can't truly believe that a person who recklessly drank themselves into a stupor and then got behind a automobile, that person is not responsible for that act, especially if it resulted in the death of children. That person, the moment they started drinking, they knew that, this is a very bad thing. I shouldn't be drinking so much. And also they knew that they should have given their car keys or taken steps to ensure that they didn't hurt anyone. So the argument for moral responsibility says if there's no free will, then there's no moral responsibility. There is moral responsibility. And this, I think they'd say, is an ethical intuition. Therefore, there is free will. So, if there's free will, then there's no moral responsibility. And the determinists will agree with this first premise. Let's say this is the... Both the determinists and libertarians will agree that if there is free will, then there's... If there's no free will, then there's no moral responsibility. What they would disagree with is this. And the determinists will actually say there's no free will, therefore there's no moral responsibility. So, there's no free will. And there's no moral responsibility. So the second part here, and this is, you know, in logic, you get this saying, one man's modus ponens is another man's modus tollens. And this just shows that what this means is that when people start out with identical assumptions like free will and moral responsibility go hand in hand, there's a couple of things you could do. You could say, okay, if there's no free will, there's no moral responsibility. As a libertarian says, I agree with that. Determinist says, I agree with that. Okay, but then they can do two different things. You could say, wait a minute, there is moral responsibility. When people do things, when they kill people, innocent people, when they commit
acts which have reckless disregard for the life and property of others and the safety of others, when they commit malicious acts to intentionally harm other people, that that's wrong, and that they deserve to be blamed for those things, that that's real, then you say that's what's most important, and therefore the logical conclusion is there must be free will in order to explain the feelings we have, in order to explain the moral world, in order to explain the reality of ethics. And the fact that we, every day, we blame and praise people, whether it's a person who cut us off in traffic, whether it's an instructor who may have given us a grade that we thought was undeserved, whether it's a politician who we think is especially corrupt and engaging in corrupt practices, whether it's a misguided friend who is supporting said politician, or you know whether it's something that's going on in our home life, right? Your loved one forgetting about Valentine's Day, or giving you a substandard gift that you expect, or you can think of lots of different things, right? That, or maybe you might have a boyfriend or girlfriend who scheduled some activity, you know, going out with the guys on Valentine's Day, and you thought this was going to be your special time together. Right, or something. So people make moral evaluations every day from the the weighty moral issues in politics to the trivial everyday aspects of driving to work or driving to school. So you make these judgments all the time. Those judgments are an illusion, says the libertarian. It's something that's real. And it's a part of our everyday experience. The determinist, on the other hand, so this is the little bit of logic lingo, modus ponens. Modus ponens. Ponens. P-O-N-E-N-S. If P, Q, actually this is the modus tollens. If P, Q, and we could say P could be no free will and Q could be no moral responsibility. We don't have to say not P, not Q. I might confuse things. So since these are both no, we can just say if P, there's no free will, then Q, there's no moral responsibility. So if P, I'm going to put then Q, just to be clear. If P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P. It gets sort of with the no's and the not's here. Not P, it means it's not the case that there is no moral responsibility. So here, it's the modus ponens. If P, then Q starts out with the same assumption, but they'll say, oh, P, therefore Q. Now, but this one man's modus ponens is another man's, or person's, if you like, to be gender inclusive, another man's modus tollens. So again, you start with the same premise. If there's no free will, then there's no moral responsibility. The determinist says there's no free will. I don't know what this letter is doing here. There's no free will, and therefore there's no responsibility. Right? If there's no free will, then there's no moral responsibility. There's no free will, therefore there's no moral responsibility. Pretty straightforward. That's called modus ponens. But you could also say, if there's no free will, there's no moral responsibility. But wait a minute, there is moral responsibility. This is false. It's false to say that there's no moral responsibility. Therefore, it's false to say that there's no free will. not Q, therefore not P. So just told it. And so it all depends on what on the second premise, which second premise you want to plug into this argument, given this relationship between free will and moral responsibility. Is it this intuition that ethics is real, that morality is real, that certain things are objectively right and wrong? Is that what's most important? Or is this, or is it all these arguments against free will that the determinists give, that we live in a world of cause and effect, that we're driven by unconscious motives, that our behavior is determined by our environment and stimulus response, or that fate, sets our course in life? Which of those, has more weight to it? And I think it's something we can talk about, and I think we'll talk about next week. So that's the argument for moral responsibility. And if you think about, again, your everyday conscious life, you either have to say, oh, there I go again, I feel guilty for something I did wrong. I promised someone that I would do this certain thing by a certain time, and I forgot, and I let that person down. Or, oh, I'm late for that meeting again. Or you think about all the things you might feel guilty for. I'm not a very good boyfriend or girlfriend because I didn't get a gift for my sweetie on Valentine's Day. And so you kind of go through all the things, or I let myself down. I made a stupid mistake on that exam, and I should have known better. And I could have gotten an A, but I got a B. And so every day, you make a moral evaluation of yourself and others, and it's praise and blame. It's guilt and feelings of achievement and self-esteem, right? So is that all an illusion? It seems sort of odd to make that argument. So the behaviorist view is very counterintuitive in this way. And I think it's one of the reasons why most people do believe in free will. And even though people will spout out this nonsense about morality being subjective, they don't really believe that. When another person wrongs them, they don't say, oh, well, that person did something I didn't like. They said, you did something wrong. That was wrong. That was unjust, right? Or if they're railing against the politician, they'll say, oh, that person is corrupt. They don't just mean, I don't like that person. They use stronger language. They say, that person is corrupt. Not corrupt to me. They mean corrupt objectively. So that's the argument from moral responsibility. And I think... sort of related to this, the argument from intuition. I think I can draw here, so 3. I can put off having to erase this board. The argument from intuition. Or what do I call this? Intuition or experience? Yeah, the argument for intuition and experience. And this is just talking about when you make a decision, it seems that from the inside, from your first person experience, that you could go either way. You're thinking, I really want to go to this conference, and I look at the planes, and I see, I could go on Friday, but there's not a good time, and it's not going to get me there early enough. And if I don't have to get up really, really early. And what if there's a delay in the plane and I'm late? So what I could do? Well, I could go Thursday. Is there anything left Thursday night? Oh, there are, but the tickets are really, really expensive. I could pay the extra money, and I could do my class live, but that's a lot of extra money. And so I could go on Thursday pre-record my class. And I think, oh, that sounds like a good idea. And I kind of weigh the pros and cons and think, well, it's going to be extra time I have to do before I go. I won't be able to interact with the students.
I'll be looking at a bunch of blank chairs. What will I do? You know, I'll just be me pontificating for an hour or two in front of the cameras. And I go, that's not the best choice, but I really want to go to this conference. And I go back and forth, right? And then it really feels like when I make a decision that it's not something that was set beforehand. It's not something which was determined by previous causes. Because it's an active thing, right? It's active, conscious choice. It's not something that happens to me. It's something that I do. And this is, I'm sort of getting into the argument from deliberation. This is actually, the argument from deliberation is related. Deliberation. Deliberation is just the process of making a decision when you're weighing the pros and cons and trying to decide what you're going to do. And so when you're deliberating over a choice and you're looking at all the different choices, so you're probably doing this today, probably not doing this today. You are doing this today, but today isn't today because I'm doing this on Tuesday. On Valentine's, that's why I'm making all the Valentine's Day comments, which are going to be old in 2 days. but if you're registering for classes, right, you're thinking, well, gosh, what classes do I want to take? This class looks like it'd be a lot of fun, but this class looks like it'd be more worthwhile and it sort of fits in with my major. This course will give me a practical skill, but it's at a bad time. It's like, oh, I saw the song. I saw this course. It was songwriting. I'm like, I like writing songs. I'd like to be more methodical about it. I like to take a course that would help me write songs. Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 8 a.m. I'm like, do I want to write songs that much? Do I want to take this class that much? And I think, oh, this is spring term. I'm going to be on campus 2 days a week for classes. And I don't have anything scheduled Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. It sure would be nice to work from home on my online classes, given my really heavy schedule. I'm going to be teaching the contemporary moral issues class Tuesday, Thursday at 1, and then I'm going to be teaching from 6 to 8 in Cottage Grove. It sure would be nice just on those Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays to be reading my online posts in my pajamas. Maybe I come up on Friday for some committee meetings or on Wednesdays, but I wouldn't have to be there. I'm thinking, that sounds really good. And so I think, songwriting, put that off for some other term, future term, maybe. Or 8 a.m., 3 days a week, maybe never. Right? So you weigh all these different things, right? And you're deliberating your mind, and we do this every day. Is that just some pointless process, or is it some deterministic process with a predetermined result? Doesn't seem like it. It seems like, yeah, I could do anything. I was looking at him, thinking I'm going to take macroeconomics. I'll be doing the contemporary moral issues class next term, and so I'm going to take the macroeconomics class, which is all about political economy, as they call it, whole industries, and talking about the money supply and the Federal Reserve and all that good stuff. And we're going to be talking, one of the things we'll be talking about in the 205 classes is a sort of socialism versus capitalism, all the craziness happening in Greece, Occupy Wall Street, lots of economic issues, and the Tea Party movement and so on. So we'll be talking about all those issues, and some of these are, you know, budgetary issues, the issues about the proper size and scope of government. And so all those issues are going to sort of fit in with the macro class. So I'm thinking, okay, those are good reasons to take that. But then, you know, some other classes I had sort of ranked lower, and I had reasons for those. I have reasons for what I do, but those reasons aren't causes. Those reasons are things which help me to make a good decision, given my values, given my character, given my likes and dislikes. It's not something which is determined ahead of time. It's something that I can consciously feel myself weighing the alternatives and try to figure out what's going to be best for me. And that's a free will choice. And, you know, we make them every day. So that's the argument from intuition experience, which is just that you have this first-person experience of making decisions and of them not feeling coerced or determined. And also
that you go through this process of deliberation, which seems like it's a free process when you're looking at several alternatives and you select the one that seems the best to you. That also seems like a free choice. It doesn't feel compelled. It doesn't feel necessary that you pick that one alternative. It doesn't feel predetermined. Then a fifth argument is the argument from regret. And boy, this is particularly you reach middle age and you're thinking, oh, woulda, coulda, shoulda, right? I should have that girl that my sweetheart in high school, I never told her how I loved her. So she was never my sweetheart, actually. But in my mind, she was, right? So you think, oh, if only I hadn't been so shy and awkward, I told her how I really felt, maybe we could be together today, right? And, or you think, oh, if only I hadn't, switched graduate schools and gone off looking for a better deal, I would have, I'd be teaching at Harvard, right? Or you sort of go through all the things that you could have done in your life. If only I hadn't shut up Coke and robbed the 7-Eleven store, I wouldn't be sitting here in prison. Or, they can be positive, too. So you can sort of have regret, and then you can also have the opposite, which I guess is pride, since I did. And so actually, let me add another one here. This actually isn't in the text, but I'm thinking I need to add another one. Pride. Our self-esteem. And true self-esteem comes from accomplishing things based on your choices and not based on some inherent characteristic you have, but on actually accomplishing or achieving something of your own free will, based on your own judgment. And the problem with the government schools, though, is they try to give everybody a gold star and everybody gets a trophy and nobody wins and you're not supposed to keep score and all these sort of anti-competitive things. But if you work really hard in a course and you earn that A, then you feel like, hey, I did something worthwhile. You finally get that college degree. You're like, hey, I worked hard for this. I got through all these courses instead of that, or in especially that dreaded philosophy course. I didn't drop out, like my brother did, who's hooked on the drugs and living on the streets. Right, so you sort of go through all the things that you did, and you think, oh, I really did it. I deserve praise for that. I accomplished something. I feel good about myself. And that's self-esteem. Or you think, oh, I did all those stupid things that screwed up my life. And now I feel really bad. I feel guilt. I feel regret. And so that the argument from regret, that feeling that you could have done something differently than you did do, is an intuition of free will. You think, oh, I did that one thing, but I could have done something else. I never told her how I felt, but I could have. And if I did, things would have turned out differently. And so you just sort of think back. Maybe you had some crazy idea for a business, right? I remember back in the 90s, I was like, I don't really like the taste of coffee. It kind of gives me sours my stomach, and it's always going to be hot. This is before the iced coffee craze, right? So it's hot, and I don't really drink hot coffee in the summer. Wouldn't it be great? I love soda, but it's only got like 30 milligrams of caffeine in it. And it seems kind of crazy to pop vitamin pills and no-dos while I'm drinking soda. And so, it'd be great if they had like some caffeinated beverage that was sweet and maybe like a diet drink, and then pretty soon like the energy drinks came and then you have like this vitamin water and caffeinated water and all these products. I mean, sometimes I think, well, if only I just, gone through and developed the product, maybe I'd be a millionaire now. Or if only I'd worked on that screenplay about the 300 Spartans holding the pass at Thermopylae. If I had done that screenplay when I was translating Herodotus, and thinking, boy, this would be a great screenplay. If only I hadn't put it off until about 6 months before the 300 came out, you know, then maybe I could have sold it for $1 million, right? So you feel the sting of regret. Now, if you're a determinist, you never feel the sting of regret, right? It's que sera, sera. What will be. Regretting the past makes no sense if you're a determinist because you only did what you could have done. It's true that if you're a determinist, from your point of view, you never could have done anything other than you did do. You never could have told that girl how you felt about her. Why? Well, because you were a shy person based on your passive, quiet father and your domineering mother, based on the fact that maybe you have sort of passive genes, maybe some from your father, maybe from a long line of docile people. So you sort of look at all the different things. Maybe it's because you grew up in a family full of sisters and didn't have any strong male role models. But all those things, the determinist will say, led to your never being able to express your feelings for the woman you left, and for her marrying that engineer and moving off to Texas or what have you, right? So it never worked out, but there's no reason to beat yourself up for it because you couldn't have done anything different than what you did do. The libertarian will say the fact again that you feel that regret, that's something that that should show you that there really is free will. Otherwise, that would just be an irrational feeling. But people feel that all the time, and when they feel regret, it feels like it's based on something. It's not just like an irrational guilt feeling or an irrational feeling that you could have done something different. It really seems like you could have done something different, and that's what makes regret sting so much. You think, oh, if only I had done X, then Y would have happened. And it wouldn't feel bad to think that if you said, oh, but I never, unless you thought, oh, I really could have done X, and then Y would have happened, but I didn't. If you never could have done X, and it was impossible, it would have been impossible for you to do X, that the only thing you could have done is the thing you did do, then you wouldn't feel bad about it at all. So, let's see. Regret, pride, and self-esteem. We got one more argument, which is the argument from poor prediction in psychology and sociology. So the argument for poor prediction in psychology and sociology says that if you look at the social sciences, how good are they at predicting behavior? So, 7. This is a little different than your book again. Well, I'll just put poor prediction. And I'll just shorten this to psychology. So psychology is a social science, meaning it's not a hard science. And what does that mean that it's not a hard science? And it means that because it's not a hard science, go away. The students are clamoring to come in now. Should have put a sign on the door or something, peering in at me. Leave me alone, students, I'm teaching. So the poor prediction in psychology and sociology is that if behavior were deterministic, if it's just sort of stimulus response, it seems like it would be really easy to both predict what people will do and also to treat people with psychological problems. But as it turns out, human behavior is one of the most unpredictable things in the world. And psychology is an extremely inexact science. And sociology does a little better because you're dealing with large groups of people. And again, just go like to the micro-macro thing when you're talking about physics. If you're dealing with one person, you don't know what they're going to do. You can sort of make some guesses, but as a psychologist, you don't know what they're going to do. But if you get a bunch of people together, you're like a political consultant, and you're trying to figure out, you know, the voting patterns of women between the ages of 35 to 55, then you can get some pretty good, you can draw some graphs and curves, and you can say middle class women 35 to 55, and they fall into fairly predictable patterns. But if you look at one individual woman who's 40 years old, you can't say, oh, white woman 40 years old makes $40,000 a year, single, I know what she believes. You can't do that. And you could look at a lot of the person's history and their character and their experiences, and you wouldn't be able to know with certainty what that person would be like. You could say, okay, here's all their experiences growing up. They're a middle child, and they're raised by a single mom, and you could say with certainty that they would have this personality and these issues, and you could know lots and lots about the person, but you could never predict with certainty what the person would be like. So that's the problem is that if determinism were true, you'd expect psychology and even sociology to be exact sciences and more exact than they are. And psychology is sort of a paradigmatic example of a social science, which means it's not a hard science, and that to have quantifiable results is sort of iffy sometimes. I know people in the psychology department, they might not like that, but when you're dealing with the neuroscience aspect of it and you're talking about biochemistry, that's one thing. But when you're dealing with the realm of human behavior, it's a very inexact science. I actually remember I had a friend who was a lawyer, and he had his client evaluated by a psychiatrist who said that the person was sane and fit and ready to rejoin society. And so as my lawyer friend was there and he was talking to the judge and sort of pacing back and forth, his client came up, and the bailiff, I suppose, was sort of snoozing or something, not paying attention. So his client picked up this giant law book, because he was saying, "Judge, my client has, undergone psychiatric evaluation, and the state psychiatrist has said that he is fit to rejoin society, that he doesn't have any problems anymore, and that he's ready to go back, and he's not going to reoffend." And as he's defending him, this client picks up this humongous law book and comes up behind him and whacks him over the back of the head. So he hits his own lawyer with this big law book, knocks him to the ground, cold cocked the guy. As the guy is defending him, and as he's about to be sprung loose, if human behavior were predictable, you'd know that that guy was going to do that. And certainly the psychiatrist wouldn't have given him a clean bill of health. And this happens all the time. You have people let out of prison, let out of mental institutions, and psychiatrists think that they're fine, and they go off and do nutty things. So. And then for any of you who've been to therapy, there have been all sorts of studies about psychological therapy, and yes, particularly talk therapy, and there have been a lot of studies that have shown that just talking to a friend or a trusted a loved one or a minister without a counseling degree, without a master's in psychology, you're going to do just about as well. And so it just shows that you think about the psychiatrist as the expert who knows everything about human behavior. There is no such person. And why is that? It's because human beings are individuals, and human beings make their own choices. Now, sometimes those choices come into patterns. Sometimes those choices can be influenced by certain factors, genetics, heredity, environment. But they are not determined by genetics, heredity, and environment. They're free choices. And so that's the argument against the argument from poor prediction in psychology and sociology. Okay, anything else about libertarian argument? I kind of glossed over this at the beginning, and I mentioned this. Libertarianism is a term that's used for the free will position, which is similar to the libertarianism as a political philosophy. It's the same term, libertarian. So a libertarian in metaphysics is a person who believes in free will in the ordinary sense of having the ability to otherwise under identical circumstances, or having the power to do otherwise under identical circumstances. Then there's the libertarian political philosophy is about having the right to do whatever you want as long as you're not hurting anyone else, or the idea of either a minimal or no state. But the idea is maximal liberty. So the, both of these come from the word liberty, which is just another Latin word, libertas, which just means freedom. So they both have to do with freedom. Why do they use the word libertarian? Why don't they just say it's a person who believes in free will? Well, it's because there's a question about what free will is. So remember I said both determinists and libertarians agree on what free will is. Well, there's another view called compatibilism. And the compatibilists say, no, both the libertarians and determinists are wrong about what free will is. Free will is not the ability to do otherwise under identical circumstances. Free will is just doing what you want to do, even if what you want to do is determined. And so the compatibilists say that free will is actually compatible with determinism. And so because these compatibilists have come in there and mucked up the terminology and say, oh no, we have a different definition of free will. You can't call the people that believe in the ordinary definition of free will, people that believe in free will now, they become the libertarians. And so that way you can say that the compatibilists say that free will and determinism are compatible with each other. Libertarianism and determinism are not compatible. They're opposite sides of the spectrum in that the libertarians say we have the power to do otherwise under identical circumstances. The determinists say that we don't. But the compatibilists say that both those guys are wrong with what free will is. And if you look at what we mean when we talk about free will, it's just making choices. And when you make choices, you're not standing outside the rules of cause and effect. So 5 minutes. When you're making choices, you're not outside the realm of cause and effect, but you're within the world of cause and effect, and you're making choices in that context. And so if you think about making a choice, sometimes people will say this. They'll say, oh, but you have a choice, right? It's not, and sometimes by that they mean it's not determined. But once the choice, when you make a choice, where does that choice come from? And the compatibilists will say, when you make a choice, you have reasons for that choice. Those reasons are going to be what causes you to act in that way. And they're going to be part of this causal chain, which leads, from causes to effects to causes to effects. If those choices just don't come out of a vacuum, they come from somewhere. Where do they come from? They come from your personality. They come from your beliefs about the world. They come from your past experiences. They come from your likes and dislikes. They come from the culture you live in, from who your peers are. So all these influences affect your decisions. And what the compatibilists will say is that as long as you're the last thing in the causal chain and it's your choice, and the choice isn't being forced or coerced by someone else, then you're free. So, to put it another way, if it's you that's the cause, if you're the one who's making the choice, then it's free. And so, under ordinary circumstances, they would say you're acting with free will. You're therefore responsible for your actions, but you're also determined. You couldn't have done anything else. So they deny this idea that moral responsibility and free will go hand in hand. Well, actually, what do they say? They redefine free will so moral responsibility and free will do go hand in hand. So they say you're responsible for the choices you make based on your character, based on who you are as a person. Even though who you are as a person is really the result of previous causes. If you make a conscious choice, you're responsible for that choice. Even if you couldn't have done otherwise under identical circumstances. So that's the compatibilist position. Again, different, totally different from the libertarian position that says, no, free will and determinism are incompatible because free will is doing, free will is having the power to do otherwise or to have done otherwise under identical circumstances. So had the circumstances been different, the libertarian would say, had the circumstances been the same, the libertarian would say, you could have done any number of things differently, that you have a free will choice and could have done something other than you did do. So the compatibilist is going to say, no, you couldn't have done anything other than what you did do, but you're still responsible for what you did do because you're the one who made the choice. And you're doing what you wanted to do. And when you're doing what you want to do and you're not being forced or coerced by someone else, then you then you're responsible for that choice and can be blamed for it or praised for it, depending on the case. Okay, let's see. Well, if you want to reach me, I'll be on Moodle periodically. We have, as I mentioned last time, the test doesn't open up till next week. So you can send me a Moodle message, I'm going to be out of town, but I'll be checking that you probably in the evenings a couple of times if you want to get in touch. No office hours on Friday, so I think my plane is actually may still be in the air at that time. So I won't have my chat office hours on Friday. But if you send me a Moodle message sometime during the weekend, I will get back to you. And then definitely Monday, I'll be back Monday afternoon or evening. I'll check all my messages then too if I haven't seen them in the meantime. But I'll have my laptop with me, and so I'll check those. I can't promise I'll be on there every day and waiting for those messages to come in, but I will check those over the weekend. I hope you have a great 3-day weekend, President's Day. Think about our presidents, including our greatest president, Thomas Jefferson, and all those, and George Washington, of course, and all those presidents who used to have their special day, but now are just lumped all into President's Day. Okay, I think that's it. That's it. I don't think I have any announcements. Our philosophy club. It had its first meeting last night, Monday at 6. If you're interested, there's a message in the social forum. Just click on that and you'll see Jason Kahn's email address. He's the person organizing things. So if you're interested, shoot him an email.